Welcome back, Left Reckoners. David here, joined as always by Matt Leck. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing good, David. Good to be with you.
Yeah, man. And we're really excited to be speaking with our guest today. We're speaking with Carrie Lee Merritt, who is a historian based in Atlanta, Georgia. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
I'm so excited to be on.
Well, I really, really enjoyed your piece in Eon Magazine, and we'll have a link below for people to read it. They definitely should take some time with it. But I found it to be a really interesting piece because, you know, most people who listen to left-wing podcasts and things like that, they sort of know about the state of the South. Hell, if you live in the South, you know about the state of the South. We're going to be last in education. We're going to be last in wages. You know, all these good things that you would like to be higher up in. This part of the country is not doing very well. And it's not, you know, a kind of recent anomaly. This has been very much like the history of this part of the country. And in your piece, you make a really interesting historical argument about why this is the case. And I was wondering if maybe to start us off, can you talk about how the South was underdeveloped and what that means maybe for somebody who might not understand that kind of concept?
Sure. So just as a preface, I am a historian, not an economist, but I do some economic history. So basically, when we're talking about development, we're talking about the markers of modern society. So things like infrastructure, things like healthcare, things like how happy people are, you know, those are all parts of development. Those are showing you how well a society is doing. And of course, as you said, those markers in the South, you know, I think I write the line, the South is good at everything bad and everything and bad at everything good. And that's really, you know, you look at those states in the Deep South where rates of slavery were the highest, and those are the most underdeveloped states, those cotton South states from South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and on into areas of Louisiana and Texas.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, this kind of aspect, I mean, this is something that, you know, again, didn't just sort of pop up out of nowhere. And maybe to sort of get into this a little bit, can we talk a little bit about this transition from, you know, the system of slavery in the South, you know, through to Reconstruction, particularly like what this ruling class is, who they are, you know, because there are, you know, some versions of Southern history that sort of will make the kind of argument that, you know, the South loses the Civil War, then there's Reconstruction and basically the same people come back. You know, is that true, or was it a different class that was able to come in and sort of take advantage of some of the systems that were put in place in the slave South?
So I, and this is based on, you know, many other historians' work that goes back to W.E.B. Du Bois, really, we all argue that this was one ruling class, a very small minority of white people who were the elite of the elite, who literally believed in aristocracy, oligarchy, did not want democracy. They were the ones lording over the South, really. They ran it like, you know, little fiefdoms. They were lords of these huge plantations, and even poor whites really had to answer to them for jobs, for wages, to stay out of the police state. And so, you know, you're talking about a very small minority of people that really run everything in the South, although about one third of white Southerners at the time of the Civil War were enslavers themselves. But so this small minority of people, they do lose control for a few years during early Reconstruction, but that's only political control because nothing was ever taken away from them. Almost no Confederate leader was ever held accountable for what they did. You know, no land was taken away from even the highest generals and officers. And so all of the big slaveholders were allowed to keep their land. And because they kept that land, they were then able to control all the labor power in the area because, you know, they were basically monopsonists. They owned the only jobs that were available around. And so they were able to then keep both blacks and poor whites in the South, and especially the Deep South, in deep cycles of poverty and debt, essentially debt peonage, up through World War II, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an important point here, too, is like there's the slave system, and then there's a lot of systems that, you know, it might be hard to argue that they're, you know, free labor. I mean, I've written for Jacobin, you know, about the Southern Tenant Farmers Union. And I mean, that was a struggle where people really didn't have the freedom to leave those plantations. Like technically, yeah, you know, for some of the folks, but they would be in debt to the plantation owners. And oftentimes they would, if you would leave, And you were indebted, they would find you. They would come out and they would drag you back. You know, this is again after slavery, and this was whites and blacks. I mean, you know, could you talk about this, like the freedom of labor in the South in that kind of post-war all the way up, you know, through the 20th century?
Right. So I think this is probably going to come back into trend of talk. When we talk about slavery, we really have to see it as one part of a system of unfree labor, the worst, most brutalized, you know, absolutely the worst part. And it was, you know, only subjected on black people in America. So that is the difference. But there are so many different types of unfree labor throughout American history, even persisting to this day when we look at what's happening in prisons and jails in this country. And so we have to look at it as a continuum. There are times that it gets better and it gets worse. But certainly, when you look at the South right after the Civil War, after the first few years of Reconstruction, when there really was a hope of blacks and poor whites really uniting in some kind of political and economic power to overthrow the elites, that of course gets crushed out by the Ku Klux Klan and different, you know, organizations of white terrorists. And so, you know, they're basically left without any kind of political power and economic power. This is the book that I still have to write, but this is exactly when we see the birth of the professional police forces in the South. It's no, you know, there's no coincidence that right after the Civil War, that's when professional uniformed police officers are, you know, outside of any major city in the South, all those forces are formed at that time. And they're really there to reinforce what's happening with laborers and making people work for these large planters.
And, you know, you talk a little bit about the relationship between this sort of plantation system and capitalism. And I wonder if you could just tease out a little bit like how that sort of, I guess, integrated or not integrated, because, you know, my understanding has always been, you know, the raw material such as sugar from Brazil or cotton from capitalism, while the plantation structure is not capitalist itself, that raw material is involved in the system broadly. And I also know, like, I read William Byrd II's diaries, and that guy was very concerned with his creditors in London. And so, yeah, just talk about the financial colonial relationship with capitalism.
Sure. So going back again to a lot of these kind of labor historians, and even if you go back to early Eugene Genovese and look at when he's talking about labor power in a strictly Marxist sense, they define the slave South as being a type of merchant capitalism. So, you know, they're producing these raw goods or raw materials, much like the areas in the global South that you just talked about. But then they're not keeping them there and you know, producing another good with them. They're instead shipping them out to another area. This time, you know, usually the North and then increasingly to England and other places in Europe. But so the raw materials are leaving the South and the capital is essentially leaving the South. And so what happens even after the Civil War, when all of these planters are, you know, have all of this land, but need cotton factories and need a way to deal with the cotton that they're producing and start industrializing, they have no capital. So they have to have Northern investors come in. Mm-hmm. And when Northern investors come in, essentially an extractive firm. You know, they're still owned by these people in the North and outside of the Southern region. So all of the capital, any profits that are made off of these ventures are then siphoned back to the North and not actually put back into the communities and in any kind of tax dollars, really, because all of these businesses are given tax breaks just to court them down to the South. So no tax dollars are going back into these local communities either.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. During H.L. Mitchell's book on the Southern Tenant Farmers Union, you know, there's this really interesting bit there about once the workers started organizing in unions in Arkansas and other parts of the South, you know, you see this huge pushback. Obviously, like, the police are breaking down, offshoots of the KKK are attacking them, and obviously to the plantation bosses. But one thing that I found was really interesting was even there were a couple plantation bosses who didn't want to sort of punish the workers for maybe joining the STFU, but they got calls in from the bank that was telling them, if you recognize these unions, we will come for your property here, right? So even for, you know, this one individual and who knows their history and story there, the fact is that the financial capital that was sort of running that area was saying is really dangerous if you start accepting higher wages for these workers and more basic protections for them. I mean, you know, can we talk about that kind of period here and like really how that relationship between, you know, finance, capital and the Southern economy, like in the 20th century sort of played out for everyday Southerners, what the consequences of that were?
Right. I mean, we're still seeing the consequences play out. Obviously, that's why especially the rural areas in these deep South states are so damn poor. They're just so incredibly poor. And you drive through parts of Mississippi, especially in the Delta, and you feel like slavery hasn't ended. That's what it looks like, you know, just visually. Essentially, because, like I said, this very, very small minority of wealthy whites controlled everything and essentially didn't have their power or their wealth broken during Reconstruction in any kind of real meaningful way. They're the ones that still own the banks, had the banks. They own, you know, most of the housing in these towns. They own all the jobs. So it's they literally still control, or their heirs, they still control these areas, these rural areas. And, you know, especially if you're a black farmer, you know, this is exactly how black land loss happens. The crisis in black farming right now is due to these kind of credit relationships, the fact that these old slaveholder heirs own banks. And then, you know, if you don't give people their loans on time, or if you give them smaller loans than white farmers, then essentially, you know, then eventually they run out of credit and they owe you and they lose their land, right? I mean, this is we're seeing this happen in real time today. It's still, we're living with all of these vestiges of really the mid 19th century.
So, I mean, so basically we're talking about an economy and a social structure that was captured by this elite class in the South. You know, I mean, how is this class able to sustain itself, you know, from like maybe attempts to try to like industrialize the South, right? Because there's a lot of people who live there. There's a lot of labor, you know, there's a lot of opportunities to make money. But, you know, this system was able to maintain itself through, you know, kind of roaring period in American capitalism.
It's kind of insane how powerful and how, you know, the kind of power structure has stayed in place for so many centuries. And like I said, is still there today in many ways. You know, they've just had complete control over everything, including what's really the worst kind of police state in all of America, if you consider things regionally. And so that's always been kind of the backbone of all of this, is either some kind of vigilante terrorism through groups like the Klan, on both blacks and poor whites. Anytime there's any kind of racial coalition under the guises of labor economics, you know, they always come in and crush those people out through violence, through torture, through killing. And then you also have the police state, you know, on the other side to buttress that. And so it really is, I always argue that the South in many ways is the most radical leftist place in the US, but there's just this, you know, very powerful elite force that has always historically been able to crush it out with terrorism and with police power.
Obviously there's a lot of power kind of domestically or like internally in the South of this class, but, you know, on the national level, you know, how is this, you know, system able to maintain itself in this period? Right. You know, I mean, I think most people sort of have this idea that the South does have a lot of power, throughout American history, despite, its population. But I mean, you know, what is the kind of reasoning for why it's able to maintain this regime within the United States, in terms of its relationship with, you know, other power structures in other regions of the country and also with Congress itself? Is it that, that they basically have been able to also control a lot of aspects of the U.S. federal government as well?
Right. Well, so obviously the South was the main force in power in control of the federal government up until the Civil War. And you see what happens as soon as the South leaves, secedes, and Lincoln is the head of government. They start passing all of these incredibly progressive reforms, the Homestead Acts. It's literally giving essentially free land to anybody who wants to go farm it and improve it. All of these things to improve people's daily lives that Southerners, you know, were consistently blocking in Congress. What happens after that gets more complicated. Essentially, what happens after the Black Codes of the 1860s and all these different attempts to disenfranchise Black men in the 1890s, the period that you know a lot about, Dave, is when you have the uprisings of populism and the starting of, you know, all these farmers' alliances and movements in rural areas. they pass, again, you know, all sorts of very strict Jim Crow laws in the 1890s to disenfranchise, again, not only blacks, but poor whites too. And so you essentially don't have a democracy in the South, not even again, for a very long time, at least, you know, in through the late 1960s.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it is an aspect, though, that is very interesting, is that, you know, the South was also very critical, you know, probably one of the most pro-labor governments that we've had, which was, you know, the FDR administration. I mean, you know, how does that play in?
So that is what kind of breaks the back of all of this slaveholder family power in many ways, because the federal government does come in and it puts in all of these federal programs that electrify the South, that bring jobs to rural areas. You know, the TVA, really, the Tennessee Valley Authority, that brought electricity throughout much of Appalachia and even the upper deep South. I mean, that I can't, you know, even describe how transforming that was for people of like my grandmother's generation, who, you know, that turned a lot of even white Southerners into Democrats, because they were finally feeling like they were recognized by the government in some kind of way after feeling left out for so many generations. I always like to go back and quote that Alabama song that, you know, they really talk about, Papa got a job with the TVA. We bought a washing machine and then a Chevrolet. And it's like they really finally got to like come up from the rungs of being the poorest whites in town and enter the middle class through these federal programs. But it also you really broke the bonds of debt peonage and you know, with different labor laws, made it illegal for the really exploitative sharecropping and tenant farming contracts to continue.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting. And also just talk about music, you know, I mean, Johnny Cash was also on the, you know, government housing, right? Which is a very fascinating thing. You know, I mean, I want to zoom out in just a minute, but first, there's a couple things that, you know, you write in your piece, and I've also heard you in other interviews talk about, you know, which is like the failure of Reconstruction. And you've used the phrase and calling there's two Reconstructions, the first one after the Civil War and the Civil Rights movement. I mean, with this first one, I mean, can we just sort of talk about, you know, how that Reconstruction sort of failed in doing what was sort of probably going to be necessary, not just to make the South better, but, you know, as to your argument, to sort of incorporate the South into like a capital system instead of the system that it, you know, ended up creating there. And two, maybe sort of like what we would have needed to see in maybe a more radical Republican Reconstruction.
Right. I mean, I think the biggest thing, again, was not punishing the leaders of the rebellion, because if that had actually happened and there had been land confiscation and dividing up those huge plantations, even to a small degree, even if you didn't take all of their land, even if you took a portion of it and gave black people their own farms to start farming so that they had some kind of basis in capital. Because, again, you think, you know, 1865, after the Emancipation Proclamation, after 13th Amendment, after everybody is free, black people in America are literally the only ethnic group to ever start out with basically zero capital. And this is happening again while the Homestead Acts are literally stealing land, Western land, from brutally stealing land from Native Americans and giving it not only to white citizens, but to white immigrants for free, while they're also telling, you know, black people, sorry, no 40 acres and a mule for your generations and centuries of slavery and rape and brutality. And so without any kind of basis in wealth, there wasn't a whole lot of way to get real power and real political power. What's going on simultaneously within the first few years by 1867, 1868 is that the federal government is pulling out all of the federal troops. And so once that happens, again, these slaveholder families come in with their terrorist groups, with KKK, with Knights of the White Camellia, with all of these kind of vestiges of slaveholder violence and basically restore the power hierarchy that was, you know, make it very similar to what it looked like in the antebellum South, where they're trying to keep blacks and poor whites apart so that there's no conviviality, that there's no talk of labor or politics or economic issues that they could, you know, share grievances about, essentially. And again, because of the federal troops pulling out and then this group of elite white Southerners taking back power, it just crushes out any kind of hope of, and there really was a hope, like those first 2 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just amazing if you go back and read those records, because these black politicians are pouring poor whites in. There's biracial meetings for the first time. I mean, it's just, it's really amazing when you see what they're offering, the kind of life and leftist, really progressive ideas that they have to make the South a better place.
Can you just talk a little bit about how this sort of aristocratic order survived? Because, you know, I, as an Oscar Wilde fan, you know, he came to America and gave a bunch of speaking tours across the country, and that's all cool. And then he met with Jefferson Davis, and, you know, it's like, oh, this is like a dinner party. Talk any sort of observations about how this sort of order sustained itself post-slavery.
Well, so it was very much based on the English aristocracy. I mean, they were very much into, they loved Sir Walter Scott and, you know, all of those old kind of books about the nobles, and really did fancy themselves this aristocracy. So they were very strict about their daughters and sons had to marry people of the exact same class, so that they could consolidate wealth and keep these large plantations and families. They even wanted, there were motions to restore law primogeniture, you know, wherever the first son inherits everything, in order to keep large plantations together, especially as things were on in the 1850s. You can see these slaveholders getting really scared that you know, something's going to give, whether it's the enslaved rebelling or poor whites or the North or, you know, whatever, something's going to give. And so they start trying to pass all of these kind of crazy sounding laws, but it really shows how much of an oligarchic hold they really do have over the region.
You know, our friend Matt Karp, his book on the pre-war South is really interesting. Just, you know, reading about, like, not only like the racial ideology, but like the kind of ruling class ideology that a lot of these, you know, white aristocrats had of themselves, or, you know, they had to create a kind of complicated connection between their kind of English, stock and the Romans and the Greeks. But you know, they were spending a lot of time trying to justify, I don't know, they're kind of above the rest of humanity, not just black folk, but all people in general.
Right. There's a whole, school of thought on their parts of that poor whites were not really racially white, you know, that they're some kind of suborder of white in order to distance themselves. And if you see them talking about them, they're always talking about them as like swarthy and dark skinned or ugly or you know, all sorts of different coded language to distance themselves from poor whites.
So, I mean, you know, and I'll just say, you know, on a personal note, I'm from Texas, but I went to high school in South Carolina, and you can still see some of those old families and some of those traditions. And it really is shocking. You know, like class prejudice is nasty in general. But it always had a very different tinge, you know, when it came from some of those folks. But I mean, I have to ask, you know, so, you know, the system has been able to maintain itself for a long time, and like we're living in the consequences of it, you know, politically and economically. You know, I mean, what is it that we would need, you know, to start doing to rectify this? Because, you know, the fact is that these families aren't able to extract as much value from just land ownership, like they might have, you know, after the Civil War, right? You know, it's diversified a lot. I mean, how could we deal with trying to address this problem, you know, in the South?
Well, that's the multi-billion dollar question, right? But I think we're starting to see, I argue in my talks that, you know, if we, again, we consider first Reconstruction after the Civil War, second Reconstruction as a civil rights movement, that we are in the beginnings of a third Reconstruction, very hopefully, that began with the 2020 protests, and then again are renewing themselves right now as we speak across college campuses, and even across, you know, all different places in the United States. And I would include labor in that. I mean, what's going on with Southern labor right now? Mm-hmm. The unionization of these auto factories. I mean, this is stuff that hasn't been able to be done in decades. And so you're seeing, I think, the rebirth of some of this activist spirit. And I'm so excited about it because, again, you know, I go back and I'm still in touch with some of these old SNCC, the Southern Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, these activists from the 1960s that are still alive. And they literally have very, very little faith in any kind of governmental help. and, you know, as the days go on, I might tend to agree with them. And so they're very much about, you know, you look in your community and what you can do right now. What can you do right now to help somebody in your community? What can you do right now to help somebody in your neighborhood? And really realizing, you know, your own strengths and your own gifts. You know, if you're not able to go out and protest on the front lines, then what can you do? Can you cook for those people? Can you form a bail fund for them? You figure out how you fit in the movement in your own way and really try to make those connections and you know, make somebody's life better in small ways. That's all we can hope for, I think, right now, because with the state of government, we've got to have some major changes before I think there's any real help on a federal level like we've seen happen, you know, in past times.
You know, on that, I think, you know, for that movement, you know, and here at Left Reckoning, we have listeners all across, you know, the South, which is something that's been a really fun part of this project. I wanted to ask you in the last few minutes, you know, about an argument that to some folks might seem academic, but I think it is actually very important. You focus on it a lot in your piece, which is sort of pushing back on this, the new history of capitalism, which has become very, very popular in the U.S., certainly in kind of left liberal circles over the past few decades. You know, could you talk about what that is, and why you might think that, like, having a stronger view of, like, the relationship between capitalism, slavery, and democracy and all these kind of things is important for our movements? Like, why does this distinction and fight matter over the new history of capitalism?
Right. So it's a really good question. It does get kind of academic, but in short, you know, history is kind of written in many ways by historians from the time that they're writing in. And so all of this kind of post-Cold War history on slavery was done in a very, you know, cheering on capitalism way. You know, capitalism just won the Cold War. And I think that kind of shows up in some of the scholarship, where I think it's really, the hand is overplayed too much. You know, again, this feeds industrial capitalism, but this is not industrial capitalism. And when you don't define capitalism at all, which this school of historians doesn't do, then you can't claim that this is capitalism, because people, especially when you're writing for the public, immediately think of industrial capitalism. And that is absolutely not possible if you think about capitalism in terms of labor power in any kind of Marxist sense. Because once you have slavery, those people do not have labor power. They do not have the ability to choose who to work for. And I even make the argument that under a society where you have almost 50% of the population enslaved, you know, those other workers don't really have a chance of having labor power either, because they're literally competing for jobs and wages with brutalized enslaved laborers. So, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword there.
No, I mean, I think it's an important thing to get right. There's been a lot on it in the past few years. And I think, you know, especially for people on the socialist left, I think that, you know, we it's important for us to get the history right, because there's a tendency, I think, to sometimes define capitalism solely as inequality, inequality both politically and certainly economically. And that's not, you know, the entirety of the socialist critique nor the Marxist critique. And it can get us into some bad habits in terms of how we're thinking about these things if we're not, you know, serious about fighting for the definitions that we're using.
Right. And I think just the last point of that, and really the biggest point I was trying to make, is that in focusing so much, you know, for people who have never maybe been to the Deep South, to talk so much about how even in the 19th century, these were, like, you know, real sophisticated capitalists running society, you then think, okay, it's a developed society. It's got all of the fixings of modernity. And that's just not the case. As we all know, that hasn't happened. It's still lagging far behind. And there needs to be a whole lot done to even bring it up to what the rest of the country is.
Well, we really appreciate you joining us on Left Reckoning this week. You know, is there anything that you'd like to plug? We'll have a piece, links to your piece below. Where can people follow you and keep up with your work?
Twitter's the main place, at Carrie Lee Merritt with one T, gets cut off. I'm on Instagram too. I'm on other places, but honestly, you know, those are the two main. I'm also trying to get a new Civil War documentary off the ground. If y'all follow at the Civil War Doc on Twitter, we are trying to get some funding, because there literally hasn't been a Civil War documentary since Ken Burns in 1990. So we need to update that.
You don't think Ken Burns exhausted the subject and treated it as well as it should have?
It literally says the cause of the war was states' rights within the first 5 minutes of the film. Yeah. So it's
get some more Shelby Foote in there. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. We'll put links for all that below and appreciate you and your work.
Thanks so much, you guys. Y'all are doing the Lord's work. Thank you. Appreciate it. Have a good one.
Thanks, Carrie Lee.